We're about to have a conversation once again with Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist and a columnist, filmmaker, author of the New York Times international bestseller, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. We're talking about her new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, which was the 2014 winner of the prestigious Hillary Western Writers Trust Prize for Nonfiction. Naomi, welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Well, if we had to take a step back at Shock Doctrine, I think you have to sit down. Just for a minute, after This Changes Everything. It is almost to me in some ways like not a sequel to, but I mean it moves from that period when things began to change drastically in the 80s and 90s in the world, our economic structure, and this is what you're arguing is the outcome.
Yeah, I mean in many ways it is a kind of a sequel to The Shock Doctrine, because The Shock Doctrine ends with Hurricane Katrina and the increased use of natural disasters to consolidate wealth at the top and to push through unpopular pro-corporate policies. And this book is an attempt to answer a question that I heard a lot when I was touring with The Shock Doctrine, which is what is a progressive response to crisis and how can we prevent this from happening? So the book is arguing that climate change, because it is the only possible outcome of an economic system that prioritizes greed over all else, must be a catalyst for a progressive transformation of our economy and indeed our values.
Well, one of the things that struck me, and I'll maybe get into a little bit later because of what you just said, is the book, though, I think, raises the question, what do you mean by progressive?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Let me get to that. Let me kind of lead up to that. I mean, let me take a step way backwards here, because I love the way you begin this book. And let me just share just some of the very beginning for our listeners, and then talk about the approach here. I mean, I'll just read a couple of initial sentences from the kind of the opening, the introduction, just for a minute. And you talk about people on an airline, and you say, "I'm in no position to judge these passengers. All of us who live high consumer lifestyles, wherever we happen to reside, are metaphorically passengers on flight 3935, which we can talk about. Living with a kind of cognitive dissonance is simply part of being alive in this jarring moment of history, when a crisis we've been studiously ignoring is hitting us in the face. I deny climate change for longer than I care to admit. I knew it was happening for sure." And then you write, "Or we look, but tell ourselves comforting stories about how humans are clever and will come up with technological miracles that will safely suck the carbon out of the skies and magically turn down the heat of the sun. Or we look, but try to be hyper-rational about a dollar for dollar. It's more efficient to focus on economic development than climate change. Or we look, but tell ourselves we're too busy to care about something so distant and abstract." So, I mean, it's a personal theory opening up here. But it's a tale of most people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because I feel like a lot of the way we talk about climate is really accusatory. You know, there's the climate deniers on one side, and then there's the rest of us virtuous people who are listening to the scientists.
Right.
And that's really not an accurate portrayal of how we interact with this terrifying crisis. You know, yes, there are, you know, the sort of Donald Trump Tea Party deniers who, you know, claim that the scientists are part of a vast wing socialist conspiracy every time it's cold outside, right? but then there's the rest of us who say we believe the science but don't act like it. And so, yeah, I wanted to start with sort of a confession of all the ways in which I looked away from this crisis for far too long, because I think that that's the sort of soft denial, and I make a distinction in the book between the hard denial of the, you know, those Tea Partiers and the soft denial of the majority of us, where, you know, how do we live with this crisis that, climate change is a spiritual crisis on many levels. It's telling us that our economic system is at war with life on Earth, that the narratives that guide, that have been guiding our society for so long, that tell us that we are in control over nature, that we can escape from nature, that we can dominate it. All of these stories are in crisis right now. So we tell ourselves all kinds of fairy tales to exert control, like those fairy tales that the market will save us or technology will save us, something's going to save us at the last minute. And I think it's important to understand how we are systematically avoiding this crisis, but also that it's that is in its own way a rational response, because we are all forced to live with this high degree of cognitive dissonance, where on the one hand, we have politicians who claim that they're taking this seriously. You know, Barack Obama talks a good game about climate change. He's not George W. Bush. You've got John Kerry claiming that, you know, climate change is a weapon of mass destruction. You have the Secretary General of the UN saying this is the greatest crisis facing the human family. And yet everywhere that we look around us, the message is the opposite. The message is, don't worry, keep consuming. We're going to double down on the dirtiest fossil fuels, those high-risk fossil fuels. So, you know, the human brain is built to try to reconcile irreconcilable realities, that, like this, the idea that this is an emergency and the fact that we're making it worse every day. So we tell ourselves stories, and so I wanted to start with those stories.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
I'm speaking with Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, Indian columnist, filmmaker, author of the New York Times international bestseller, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. We're talking about her new book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, which was the 2014 winner of the prestigious Hillary Weston Writers Trust Prize for Nonfiction. The whole question of self-denial is kind of the subtext of this book, in one of the subtexts of this book, because it's hard for any of us. I was thinking about this conversation we're going to have today last night when I was home, and my wife, Valerie, was feeling under the weather. We were trying to keep heat off until November and just use the fireplace. So we turned the heat on. Mm-hmm. And turn the heat on in our home means you turn on the oil heat.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what we heat our house with, because right now we can't afford all the solar we'd like. But you have to do that to understand that climate change is disastrous, like all the power folks who said say it. On the other hand, it means that we're going to have to overturn our way of life and change how the world lives. And I think that's why it's so difficult for people who believe it and are soft deniers to go, we have to change it.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a failure of policy, right? I mean, the fossil fuel companies have been incredibly good at flipping that fact that, yeah, you do have to turn on the heat, and you like most people, live in a municipality that is driven, that has its power grid still in the hands of fossil fuel interests.
Right.
So then they say, well, look, you know, you're just as guilty as we are. You know, you want this. And that's just not true. I mean, most people would be perfectly happy to have their lives powered by renewable energy, but that's not an option that's given to them. Most people would be happy to take public transit if it was accessible and affordable and comfortable. And we make it inaccessible, unaffordable, and uncomfortable for most people, right? So that part of this is, you know, as you know, the sort of driving thesis of the book is that this is a crisis that suffers from catastrophically poor historical timing, in that it landed on our laps in the late 1980s at the most triumphant moment for free market fundamentalism. And because of that, so many sensible policy responses to this crisis were seen as, you know, heretical. That, of course, we couldn't just regulate the fossil fuel companies and invest massively in the public sphere, because this was a time when governments were opting out of governing, when they were selling off the public sphere, indeed selling off precisely the sectors of the public sphere that are most critical to an energy transition, right? Transit, rails, airlines, energy. This was all being auctioned off to private companies that would be driven only by for-profit interests. So here we find ourselves in this moment where we don't have those policy responses, and then the fossil fuel companies turn around and try to sell that to us as our consent. But it isn't consent. It's an absence of good choices. And the green groups, who I do go after, you know, pretty strongly in the book, some of them, I think have been complicit in this, in presenting climate change for far too long as something that could be dealt with just through individual consumption, right?
Right, right.
Change your light bulbs. you know, buy a hybrid, put up your own solar panels, and that, you know, that in and of itself is a problem because that reinforces this idea that it is all of our fault, and it isn't. You know, we are not all equally guilty. There are driving interests here.
And going back to the 80s and 90s, and talk a bit about, I mean, you write some about Jim Hansen's testimony in 1988 and that period of time and the Berlin Wall, the falling of that, the falling of the Soviet Union and Stieglitz's work. And I was thinking about this because this week was the, I think Monday was, or last week was the anniversary of the discovery of the ozone hole in 1986 over the Antarctic, which began to blossom this debate in many ways for the world.
Yeah, and I mean, what's interesting is the Montreal Protocol was the response to that collective crisis, and it was passed in 1987, and it was this sort of top-down response. It was still considered acceptable for governments to get together and just ban harmful substances or tightly regulate them, and that was the model for dealing with the substances that were largely responsible, and that has been a success. I mean, the ozone is healing itself because of those actions. But then, you know, 1 year later, Hansen testifies on Capitol Hill and says that he has a high degree of certainty that greenhouse gas emissions are already leading to warming. This year, 1988, is the key year for climate change in that, you know, scientists understood this connection earlier, but this was the year that it leapt into the realm of international policy. Governments had their first meeting in Toronto, it was held, where there began to be negotiations to set emission reduction targets. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was formed that year. A few years later, we had the Rio Earth Summit and the signing of the UN Climate Convention. So the reason why that year is so fateful is because it is the year that the first free trade agreement was signed between Canada and the U.S. that eventually was extended into NAFTA. It's the year before the Berlin Wall collapsed. It's the year that Francis Fukuyama declared history over. So it is the peak of this triumphalist moment for this ideology. And before that moment, it was possible for governments to get together and come up with sensible regulatory responses. But after that moment, when they came together, for instance, in Kyoto to sign the Kyoto Protocol, it was all about creating market mechanisms to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And that was the model that was enshrined in the Kyoto Protocol. It's the reason why Europe has an emission trading system as a response to climate change that has been completely ineffective, indeed catastrophic. It has seen emissions rise. It has been a magnet for fraud, like so many of these market mechanisms. But I mean, when you're trading in air, you know, it's particularly likely to attract dodgy characters.
Well, the whole trading thing I want to get to, because I think that's where, well, we'll get to that in just a moment. I mean, I think that early in the book, there's this chapter, The Right is Right, and you have a conversation with Joe Bast of the Heartland Institute and others. And I think that it's interesting that they get it.
I mean, by the way, they just reviewed the book the other day.
It's
of the most hilarious reviews.
I should have read that before we got on the air. I didn't see that one.
They gave me the highest praise that it's possible for the right to give, which is they said it was a left-wing version of Atlas Shrugged. I realized that this was their idea of a compliment.
I think it is.
Quite terrifying.
So now you have to write the novel. I always called it Atlas Shrugged. I always called it the masochist lollipop. This was so huge. But... But I mean, they do get it, and I think that's, yeah. And when I have read some of the conservative reviews and reviews from the press that supports the oil industry, that they do get it, and that's the frightening part.
Well, I mean, I feel like when I interviewed prominent figures in the climate change denier movement, like Joe Bast, the head of the Heartland Institute, or you know, we interviewed my partner Avi Lewis, who's making a documentary to go with the book, and
I knew that was going to happen.
He interviewed the people that we thought might not sit down with me, like Mark Morano. And you know, they're completely frank about it. They understand that if the science is true, it would be the end of their ideological project. That it would be, as they say, you know, a gift to the left, as Joe Bast said. They would be able to intervene in the market however they wanted. So they, as Joseph Bast told me, so I took another look at the science, right? So they looked at the science in order to try to poke holes in it, which is what this whole movement is about. Because if the science, they understand very deeply that if the science is true, it requires a massive ideological shift. So I make the argument that these guys are wrong about the science, but in many ways they are more right about the politics or the political implications of the science than many sort of centrist liberals who don't deny the science but then tell us that the market can fix this for us and that it won't be disruptive at all. You won't even notice it. That's not true. You do not get a society founded on fossil fuels. You know, that fossil fuels birthed the modern capitalism. You do not shift away from them in ways that you barely notice. That doesn't happen in reality.
So, I mean, that's exactly what, to me, that was so important about all this conversation that you're generating with this book is that when you look at the parts of the book where you talk about folks who believe in the win-win, the big greens, the big environmental groups, Nature Conservancy, Richard Branson that you take on from Virgin Airways, the Walmart Environmental Defense Fund connections, all that that you talk about.
All those bridges I burn.
All the... You're done now. You'll get no more money ever.
But, moldering in my wake.
But that, to me, is that's part of it, because I think there are people, and I know many of those people who are in those environmental groups, and I've interviewed some of those large capitalist groups as well, mm-hmm. and many of the environmental groups, they want to save the earth, they want to save people, but they see the only way to do it, as you write about in here, is in partnership with capitalism, because that's the only way they can...
Yeah, that's their theory of change,
right,
is the trendy language of nonprofits these days. You know, the theory of change is that we don't have time for, large-scale social transformation. So rather than building a social movement from the grassroots, rather than mobilizing the people who this system is failing on multiple levels, right... It has to be an elite-driven process, and it's often very explicit. You know, Richard Branson tells a story about how Al Gore came to his house and showed him his PowerPoint presentation back in 2006 and said, this is not going to be a grassroots process. It has to come from the top. And if you think
right.
about, you know, that moment, that inconvenient truth moment, it was all about marshaling elite opinion, right? Hollywood celebrities and billionaires and corporations, you know, all sort of voluntarily saying, we're going to go green. And as my friend Bill McKibben, you know, says, like, they had all the trappings of a movement except for a movement of a people. You know, they've got the people. So, you know, the theory of change was that this is the only way that things will shift. And you know, the argument I'm making is, okay, well, you had a couple decades, and emissions are up 61%. We don't have another decade to lose. So let's try another theory of change, which is, why don't we tell the truth about how radical this challenge is? And the good news is that this economic system that is at the heart of this crisis is failing people on multiple levels. We can build an economy that addresses the inequality crisis and the climate crisis at the same time. And the real win-win is introducing climate policies that actually reduce emissions and that rebuild our crumbling public infrastructure, our neglected inner cities, that actually hold the promise of good manufacturing jobs. I mean, we can do this, but it's not the kind of win-win of, you know, Walmart wins and the planet wins, because we tried that and it just doesn't hold up.
All right, well, so the question is, though, I think, and I kept thinking about this as I was reading these parts of the book, was that, I mean, how you begin to take that on. You know what I'm saying? How you confront that reality, because that reality also touches people who work in all these places we're talking about.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, and that who want to believe that this is the way that the change can be made when you have the Nature Conservancy you spend a lot of time talking about, or Walmart, the Environmental Defense Fund, which is a group that lots of people give to. They get that envelope in the mail and they send that $1, that $10, that $50 to support that work.
Yeah, and I make a distinction between the people who support these groups and the leadership at the top, and also a distinction between some very good local work that they do. For instance, the Nature Conservancy has conserved huge swaths of wilderness. But that model doesn't really work when it comes to climate change, because that model does actually work on this sort of elite consensus of like, okay, let's all, I mean, that's actually the history of the conservation movement in the United States, is kind of a gentleman's club, right? The Sierra Club started out as a hiking club,
hiking
and many
club,
of these
right.
groups started out as hunting clubs. And it was, you know, it was very wealthy, almost exclusively men who were themselves industrialists, but still wanted to protect parts of nature for their enjoyment. And so the problem is applying that model to something as fundamental as the fact that industrial capitalism itself has created the climate crisis. So I think we have to make that distinction between members of these groups and also some very good work that many of these groups do. And, you know, the good news is that we're not starting from scratch. The good news is that this is really about bringing different movements together. There are so many people who have such profound reasons for challenging this same economic system. You know, whether they are fighting the militarization of their cities, the privatization of the prison system, the foreclosure crisis. I mean, these are all symptoms of the same crisis, and climate is just sort of layered on top of that. So it isn't about building a new movement from scratch. It's about connecting the dots between all these other movements that are fighting their own manifestations of this same ideological project. And so so I'm arguing that the drive to avoid that fundamental ideological debate that we've seen from the big green groups and try to make climate fit within that ideological framework is a strategy that has been tried and has failed. So now let's actually talk about the ideology and bring all of these different movements together and build a broad-based social movement out of it. The other thing is that I think we're starting to see that. You know, the climate march in New York City in September during the UN summit. I mean, that was a turning point, not just because of the huge numbers, but because it mobilized constituencies that the traditional climate movement has always failed to mobilize, right? It mobilized low-income people, it mobilized trade unions, it mobilized the communities that are most directly impacted by fossil fuel extraction and combustion, those frontline communities who also saw in climate action their best hope for jobs and infrastructure. So it really was a climate justice march, not just a climate march. So this is already starting to happen. We're not starting from scratch. And I think people are starting to realize that model of even just sending money to any group, whether it's a lousy group or a good group, that also isn't going to cut it. We need to organize in our community.
So when you talk about, let's talk about this, a gigantic social democratic country that you talk about a lot in the book, which is Germany,
mm-hmm.
and that has put all this money into solar, 25%, I think is where they're going with solar, but also
25% all renewables.
Renewables. Excuse me. You're right. But you also talk about is the power of the coal industry and how that it's gotten more intense in terms of the pollution, not less, in Germany because of the power of coal, even if it's shipped out. So I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, so and then you talk about the cooperatives that are trying to attack it by controlling the grid in their communities. So there's a lot of contradictions in that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like what's happening in Germany is really important because it shows us a couple of things. I mean, first of all, you know, the argument I'm making is that we've failed to deal with climate change because we're locked into this neoliberal framework. And what you see really clearly is that the countries that have some of the best policies in place tend to be the countries that have the strongest social democratic tradition that never went full tilt neoliberal, right? So the obvious example are the Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Denmark. You know, they have fantastic green policies. Norway is its own problem because they bound oil, and even though they have lots of green policies nationally, they're still a major problem because Statoil is invested in the tar sands and pushing into the Arctic. That said, you know, if you, the best examples, you know, every time you see a list of, you know, the greenest countries, there is a clear correlation between how social democratic those countries are, and their willingness to embrace green policies, because they're willing to break the rules. They're willing to subsidize industry. They're willing to engage in economic planning. So that's been the case with Germany, with their move away from nuclear and this very rapid transition to renewable energy. 25% of the grid, as you said, now coming from renewables, much of it decentralized. It's a really, really well-designed system because it encourages community ownership. So it's a real win-win in that communities are not just switching to cleaner energy, but they are keeping the benefits of that energy in their communities to pay for social services. So in many cases, it's been accompanied by a democratic decision by a city or a town to take their energy grid back from the private company that bought it out in the 1990s. So there's a reversal of privatization going on a huge scale in Germany. This is happening in hundreds of cities and towns, and it's an incredibly unreported story in North America. But the flip side of that is that Germany has been unwilling to break the sort of cardinal rule of the neoliberal era, which is that it's been unwilling to stand up to the fossil fuel lobby. So Merkel is not regulating coal. She's still leaving that side of it to the market. And that's because Germany is part of the emission trading system that was set up under Kyoto in Europe. So they're relying on a weak market mechanism to regulate coal, and it's not working, just as it's not working all over Europe. So I think what the German example shows is that if we want to take this crisis seriously, we need powerful yeses. We need policies that allow us to say yes forcefully to the kind of energy that we want, but we also need to remember how to say no to the fossil fuel lobby, and that's what all of our governments are so bad at. Look at Barack Obama taking 3 years to just say no to the Keystone XL pipeline, and he still can't seem to do it.
Right, and probably won't do it. Probably leave it in limbo. But is my guess. But we'll see. I mean, I want to think about Germany a lot, because really think a lot about what you wrote here, and juxtaposing that with what you quote Mark Jacobson from Stanford saying we can change economically, yes. We can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take this kind of dramatic change. And let me start with the history part, because you spend a lot of time in this book on history back and forth. And you make these connections between slavery and reparations and the battle for reparations by many, which is something we talk about a lot on this program.
Mm-hmm.
And we all talk also on this program a lot about how there would have been no Western capitalism without slavery. Would not have existed in the way we have it now.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tie that. I'm not going to make it too convoluted here, but we tie that into what you write about James Watt and Sir Francis Bacon and the origins of capitalism and how that all began.
Yeah.
I mean, so two things. A, we're talking about a huge, massive system across the globe that has control of the globe completely, and we're talking about a system that. People, not to say, if they haven't bought into it, it's how we live our lives. I mean, we talked about at the very beginning of this conversation. So that's why it's so difficult, I think, for people to put their hands around it, even though they look at this and go, God, she's right. But, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's a heavy lift.
Yeah, no question.
And that's why I think that we really have to not think of this as just an issue for environmentalists, because there's no way the environmental movement on its own can do this. But when we think about the other pressing issues that often distract people from climate change, right? I mean, people are focused on on police violence. They are focused on the state of their education system, their healthcare system, all of these multiple crises. So, to me, the only hope is if there can be a movement that is ignited by a positive vision of transformation that sees a response to climate change being the catalyst to building a more just economy and a more humane society and fighting all these multiple battles. So No, in many ways, this is, you know, it's as unlikely that we will do this as we will fight any of these other ills, right? But the issue is that climate change puts us on a science-based deadline and tells us the fate of humanity lies in the balance here. And the good news is we're not starting from scratch. The good news is that people are in the streets already,
right,
trying to fight all these different manifestations of this flawed system. You know, I was really heartened to, when the day after the big climate march in New York, there was Flood Wall Street. And a lot of the people who were part of that action, you know, this was the big sit-in that was held right near Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those people had been part of Occupy Wall Street three years earlier. And at that time, you know, I was really struck that that movement of largely young people who were sort of calling out the failures of this economic system were not really including climate change as part of this discussion, indeed as the biggest failure of this same logic that was foreclosing on people's homes, was foreclosing on our collective home. And in the intervening years, there's been Hurricane Sandy, and there has been the Occupy Sandy in response to that. And so now people are connecting the dots, and we are seeing this genuine, you know, grassroots climate justice movement emerge, connecting the dots between all of these different manifestations. So that's where I place my hope. And when I say that, I don't mean, you know, I'm just sort of a sunny optimist saying, well, we can do this, no problem. This is huge,
right.
You know?
No, it
but
is
I
huge.
Think we have a moral responsibility if we see any possibility that we could prevent the catastrophic outcomes that climate scientists are warning us about. You know, if we stay on the road we're on, we're headed towards catastrophic levels of warming, and all we have to do to bring that on is nothing. You know, just keep doing what we're doing. So, and you know, the International Energy Agency tells us that the next 5 years will seal the fate for generations. So, you know, this is the do or die moment, and there are, you know, but you know, it's not like we're talking about an economic system that's working beautifully, except for the small matter of rising sea levels.
Really.
There are some other issues that I think you've discussed on the show as well.
Yes, I think so. let me. There's a quote in here I want to pull out just because, to talk a bit about as we close out, I think it's important that it fits into what you're describing. When you take this quote from David Brian Davis, who's a really interesting historian about the abolitionist movement.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just read it for our listeners, and we can kind of jump off from this. It said, "The abolition of New World slavery depended in large measure on a major transformation in moral perception, on the emergence of writers, speakers, and reformers beginning in the mid-18th century who were willing to condemn an institution that had been sanctioned for thousands of years and who also strove to make human society something more than an endless endless contest of greed and power." And literally, from that perspective, it's a little, in our perspective now, it is taking on the whole capitalist system. It is pushing. If we don't, then we're taking on the wrong stuff.
That's right. And this is one of the reasons why I take a lot of hope from the fossil fuel divestment movement that has spread on hundreds of university campuses and through different faith organizations and city councils, because they are speaking in the language of morality that has been missing from this crisis for so long. And they're using very much that rhetoric of the abolition movement of saying these are immoral profits, right? And indeed, these are odious profits. And so that creates a context in which not only are we separating ourselves from this industry, but then we also have the possibility of having a polluter pays, justice pays framework, right? If these profits are so illegitimate that Harvard should divest, you know, that Stanford has sold its coal stocks or is in the process of selling its coal stocks, then it also follows that the public has a right to those profits. If they're illegitimate and we're accepting that and these moral voices carry the day, then that means that the public has a right to those profits to pay for the transition. Because that's a big part of what's making us feel so hopeless, is the collision between this, let's face it, very expensive crisis and the fact that we're told incessantly that we're broke, right? And, you know, we aren't broke, but the money's in the wrong place. And that's why that this process of delegitimizing those profits lays a really important precedent and groundwork for there to be a polluter pays response.
I just think this is this this you know I really loved your previous book a great deal, Shock Doctrine, the rise of disaster capitalism, but this changes everything. Capitalism versus the climate is a very critical book, and I just want to thank you so much for writing it, for one.
Well, thank you.
And for taking the time with listeners. I know you're really busy, and the two of you are doing a lot of work, so I appreciate you taking this time with us today.
It was a real pleasure to talk with you, Mark.
Thanks so much. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.